Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. You want to contribute to charity, you believe it's important, but it isn't easy to find the money or remember to follow through. We'll look at a new app from Milo and Canada Helps that's working to change that by rounding up your small purchases and allowing you to donate your spare change. Then, there are certain types of insurance we all need, homeowners or renters insurance, auto insurance. But when it comes to life insurance, the answer isn't so clear cut. PWL Capital Associate Portfolio Manager Benjamin Felix will take us through the different forms of life insurance and talk about what you should be looking for in a policy for yourself. And most women don't realize it is going to cost them more to afford the same level of retirement as men for a whole host of reasons, longevity, the pay gap, all that stuff. We're going to talk about why and what to do about it with personal finance expert and founder of Always Save Money, Rabina Ahmed Haq. Plus, Prosper Canada has a new digital learning hub that's working to financially empower low-income Canadians. Prosper Canada CEO Liz Mulholland will be here to tell us about that. And before you move in together, what every couple should know and talk about before combining their finances. All that's ahead. Let's get started. You may have heard of apps that round up purchases you make and then invest the change in a savings account or retirement fund. But what if instead you could donate that spare change? It's called Round Up to Give, and it's part of a new mobile app from fintech company Milo and donation platform Canada Helps. Joining us now to tell us more is Canada Helps Chief Marketing and Product Officer Shannon Craig. Hello there.
Hi there.
This is a great idea. This micro-investing idea, relatively small in Canada in terms of awareness, but bigger in other parts of the world. This is a new application to the charitable sector. How does it work?
It's great. It's actually really quite simple. Any Canadian can go to the Milo website, download an app for Android or their Apple smartphone. And effectively, all they have to do is, you know, provide a little bit of information, link their bank account, and they can choose how they want their giving to happen. So with every purchase that they make, say they buy a coffee for $3.25, Milo will round that up to $4 and invest the 75 cents. They can either choose to invest it in a financial investment, put it toward the savings goal, whether that be a trip or their first home, or what's most exciting to us at Canada Helps is that they can actually donate that to a charity that they care about. And so slowly over the time, as the week goes by, the months and the year goes by, that turns into a large, significant gift that can really help out charities.
Can you have multiple goals on the platform? So can you say, I want to save this amount for retirement and then everything else goes up to round up? Or do you need to choose just one?
No, you can absolutely have a few different goals set, and you can actually even choose to amplify your goals so that it's more than just a small ramp up. Maybe instead of just rounding up, you're doubling the round up. Or you can also choose to do additional gifts. Say you just got a bonus, so you can add on an additional one-time gift to any one of your goals. So it's really quite a flexible application that lets you to move your money as you have it.
It's very easy for me to see what's in it for Milo. They're building awareness and hopefully they'll build up more accounts for any of their products. What's in it for Canada Helps?
Well, Canada Helps is a charity and a social enterprise, and we've been providing a one-stop shop where Canadians can donate or fundraise to any registered charity in Canada. Our mission is to inspire giving, to get Canadians engaged in philanthropic giving, and we're thrilled to do this because there's a lot of different trends happening in giving when it comes to generational giving, what younger donors want in comparison to more traditional, older donors. And we think that this is a really innovative approach to inspiring giving that really resonates with younger donors.
What are some of the positives and negatives of this shift towards online donations? I know in your giving report you talked about an enormous percentage increase. It does mean for someone like me, I'm just not willing to give at the door anymore, right? So there's no point in people door knocking because I'm going to go to Canada Helps or I'm going to go direct to a charity and do it that way. What are the pros and cons of that shift?
Well, I think the pros is that, you know, it makes giving available at any time of the day. You're able to make a gift to an organization that you care about. And because it's a digital world, you know, Canadians can go out there and learn so much about the great work that charities are doing. They can take the time, they can get access information at their fingertips online. And, you know, with an application like Milo, you can really give in a painless way. You don't notice the 75 cents, but, you know, at the end of the week when that's $10 and at the end of the year, that's over $500. That's a significant contribution. So I think, technology makes giving easier and allows information to be at our fingertips. But I think the interesting thing that's maybe the challenge of the situation is that, you know, as younger generations are now at a point in their lives where they have disposable income and can really start to give back, they expect a lot of information. And I think it's really important that the charitable sector is able to respond and embrace these changes. So really what we're hearing from younger donors more than previous donors is that they really want to know the impact a charity's making. They want charities to be sharing the great work that they're doing and have a really good sense of the true impact that they're creating. And so I think, with technology comes increased expectations, and some of those expectations that younger donors are really asking for are really positive, and I think all Canadians will benefit from.
I got the most amazing phone call from an alumnus of the Pathways to Education program. I'd made a donation. I got this great call. It was a voicemail, but I just loved it. He was talking specifically about how the program had made a difference. So absolutely, that resonates. Now, is there a fee for people who use Roundup to give? How does that work?
Yes. So overall, Milo has a $1 fee per month for investing your funds. And every time that there's a donation made, so what happens is that your roundups to your donations get counted up, and then at the end of the month, Milo sends the proceeds of your roundups to Canada Help so we can disperse it to the charity of your choice and provide you with a tax receipt. We do take 2% of the donation, and this really allows us to continue with our charitable mission of connecting Canadians to every charity they care about on CanadaHelps.org. But as well, we provide online fundraising tools for charities. So really what these tools allow charities to do is we ensure that all charities, regardless of size, have access to the fundraising tools they need to succeed. So that's what that small fee allows us to continue to do.
There was a lot of attention on GoFundMe, a U.S.-based organization, in particular after the Humboldt tragedy, given how much money was raised so incredibly quickly. How does Canada Helps differ versus some of those platforms? And GoFundMe isn't the only one. There's many. How does Canada Helps differ?
Well, so we only disperse funds to registered Canadian charities. So those charities have higher levels of accountability. They have specific mandates that they must be fulfilling and that they're regulated by the CRA. And we think that's a very important distinction. You know that the funds, there's oversight and accountability in terms of how those funds are being used. And they're all public organizations, so that information is also accessible to us all.
How does the app address peer-to-peer fundraising? I mean, we know that millennials and Gen Xers, I'm a Gen Xer, we're so influenced by what's going on in our social network. How does it relate to this notion of peer-to-peer fundraising?
Sure. Well, one of the things that the app does so well is that it exposes, they're using our Canada Helps database so that they can expose every Canadian charity. So really providing the choice that we know millennials want. They don't necessarily give to the same organization that their parents gave to. They're thinking for themselves. They care about a cause and they're going out to find the organization that they want to support. So that choice is really important. But it also means that there's so many charities in Canada, they're going to find an organization that maps to the cause that they care about and that they are discoverable, you know, by things like what community they're in, what category, what's the type of work that they're doing and so forth. So a really easy way to find charities as well.
Your report also found that fewer Canadians are making donations, charitable donations overall. Do you think automation is a way to at least stem the decline?
Absolutely. So, yes, we are finding that, overall donations are going down. The one thing that is super exciting, online donations are going up. So we've seen about 22.5% annual growth on our Canada Helps online platform per year. So that's exciting that online is helping to address that gap. But also what's really exciting is that the fastest growing revenue donation stream on our Canada Helps platform is actually monthly donations. They now actually account for 33% of donations made through our platform.
Wow.
And so that's a really positive sign because I think, as much as, the entire charitable sector is how do we ignite younger donors because they're donors of tomorrow. You know, one of the exciting things, I think, is that younger donors, they care. And with programs like this, like Milo's, that make it really easy to give small amounts that add up, it makes it, they want to give in a meaningful way. And this provides them with a way to make a meaningful gift that isn't as hard. It's hard to come up with $500 on any one given day. But as you do it slowly over time, over the year, it's you know you're making a difference.
I am a big fan of automation, so I'll be interested to see how this plays out. Shannon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shannon Craig is Canada Help's Chief Marketing and Product Officer. She joined us to talk about a new program called Round Up to Give, which is based on the app Milo in partnership with Canada Help's.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Well, no one wants to think about the bad what ifs in life. No one also wants to leave their family financially shattered if something unexpected happens. But is life insurance really worth it? There's a lot of factors to consider when choosing a policy and whether or not you should get one at all. Here to tell us more is Benjamin Felix. He's an associate portfolio manager with PWL Capital and the blogger behind Common Sense Investing. He joins us from Ottawa. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
Who needs life insurance? And I'm going to expect that you will give me your most objective answer possible, because if your prime source of income was selling life insurance, I bet it would be different than the one you're going to give me now.
That's right. And that is not my primary source of income. Anybody that has dependents relying on them financially needs life insurance for their family to be financially secure. People that don't have life insurance but do have financial dependents, they may still be fine, which is the whole point of insurance, I guess, but they may also not be fine. And if something ends up happening to them, their family can be in a lot of trouble.
And so the inverse, who doesn't need life insurance? If you don't have dependents and you're, you know, single on your own, can you avoid a policy altogether?
Yeah, I think if there's no one depending on you, if you die, as sad as it may be for your family, if they weren't depending on you financially, for example, your parents who may be financially independent themselves, if you're a young adult and you pass away, no one's going to be hurt financially. So in that case, you probably don't need life insurance. Likewise, the parents in the example that I just gave who are financially independent, if either spouse passes away, if they were already financially dependent based on their assets or pensions, then they probably didn't have much of a life insurance need.
So we're going to take the sort of play out this example of someone who does need life insurance. They do have dependents. How do you begin the calculation on how much you need?
The method of calculating varies, and the assumptions that are used are going to vary, and they'll have a probably meaningful impact on the end result. So I'd say that's a little bit subjective, but at a basic level, it's taking the amount of income that needs to be replaced and figuring out how much capital, how much money would be needed by your dependents today to replace that income for X number of years. Say it's 20 years or 15 years, depending on the family situation.
And how do you factor in two income earners in a family? More and more, both people are working their tail off just to pay the mortgage. How do you figure out how to account for that and acknowledge that there can sometimes be a big difference in income? Do you insure only the higher earning spouse? Do you insure both? How do you think through that?
I would look at the total expenses of the household and figure out how much each spouse is contributing to the budget. So if there's one substantially higher earner who could feasibly maintain all of the household expenditures, maybe there's an argument that the lower income spouse does not need to have life insurance. On the other hand, if the lower income earning spouse was, for example, saving all of their income towards retirement, then the death of that spouse would still have a long-term impact on the family's financial outcome. So there may be an insurance need. But the insurance need for the higher earning spouse is most likely quite a bit higher than for the lower earning spouse.
There are two basic types of life insurance: term insurance and permanent insurance. Term is simpler. It is cheaper on a monthly basis. What circumstance does permanent insurance make sense? When you're adding that layer of, you know, the investment element to it, who does that make sense for?
I would say it's a very unique situation where somebody has more capital than that they're going to need to spend themselves, than they're going to need to spend themselves in their lifetime. And they want to plan for either a gift, a charitable gift on death, or a specific expense if they know they're going to have a tax bill of a specific dollar amount, or they want to leave a very specific amount to their children. Life insurance is a way to guarantee that, permanent life insurance. As an investment, which I think it's often sold as to younger families, I don't think it's a great investment. It's not liquid. The returns, if you can call them that, in the policies are not great, and they're very expensive in terms of the cost of insurance.
What should the consumer know about how a life insurance broker is compensated? Because there's a pretty big difference. If you've got a couple sitting in front of you and you can sell them one or the other, don't you make a heck of a lot more on a permanent insurance sale?
Yeah, it would be an order of magnitude more, probably 10 times more that you would make on a permanent sale than a term. I mean, I guess depending on the amounts of coverage, but it could be a lot more, suffice it to say.
It's important for people to know as they listen to the pitch.
It's very important for people to know. I'm also careful with that because as much as I do think there is definitely a conflict of interest in the way that insurance brokers are paid, but I think that also causes a problem for people who are receiving insurance advice, where an insurance broker may be giving very good advice about the amount of insurance they need, but the consumer might be skeptical of the advice because they're concerned about the conflict of interest. So I think it's important to be very careful with that one.
What would be an example of the commission that a broker would earn? If it's a term insurance, it's 10-year, it's $500,000, what's like, is it a dollar or is it $10,000? What's their commission going to be?
It's been a while since I've sold an insurance policy myself, but I think it's around 40 or 50% of the first year premium. So if a term 10 insurance policy for a male costs, say, $25 a month, times 12 is a year, $300. The advisor might make, I don't know, a couple hundred dollars on that term policy.
But and a couple thousand on a permanent insurance.
Exactly. That's correct. Yeah. A few thousand on the permanent insurance.
Does the insurance company matter? I know when we talk about, you know, property insurance and auto insurance, there's a whole bunch of benefits that a broker might illuminate in terms of, you know, dealing with this insurance company versus that insurance company. Is there any nuance when it comes to life insurance on who your insurance is actually with outside of the broker?
It's a really important question, and there are nuances. There are small features that different insurers will have on their policies. An example might be the ability to convert to a permanent policy or to convert to a longer-term policy within a set period of time. Those time frames where conversion is allowed can differ with various insurance companies. And little details like that can be important depending on the situation. One issue that I see sometimes is that people will price shop insurance because it's fairly easy information to find. And a policy that might have slightly better features for your situation may cost a couple of extra dollars per month. And again, consumers will be skeptical of an insurance advisor saying this policy has features that will be beneficial to you. They may be skeptical because the price is higher. But in some cases, those extra features can actually be beneficial.
Just briefly here, disability insurance, when does that make sense? It's not cheap. It can be a couple hundred bucks a month, depending on how much income you're trying to replace.
Yeah, so I think anyone that has a relatively high income, group disability will often have a cap on it. So that's one case. Another case is people who are in highly specialized fields, obviously like somebody like a physician, maybe an accountant, other professionals like that. Group disability will often have what's called a two-year own occupation clause, which means that it will cover you if you're not able to perform the duties of your own current occupation. So if that's an accountant, accounting, a doctor, doctoring. That's not a word.
It's a word. You just made it up. Congratulations. I gave it to you.
Thank you. If they can't go back to their actual job, then the insurance policy will pay. But if they can go back to doing something else other than their own occupation after years, then the insurance company may stop paying. If you purchase your own private disability policy, you can purchase one that will pay if you can't go back to your own occupation until age 65.
Right. Really worth us investing some of our intellectual capacity in understanding insurance. Benjamin, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Bruce.
Benjamin Felix is an associate portfolio manager with PW Capital. He blogs at Common Sense Investing, and he was here to talk to us about insurance, life insurance in particular. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, we're going to talk about why women need to save more than men for retirement and how they can do it. The reasons make me crazy. And later, when it comes to asking your partner to move in, the question is almost always about love and rarely about money. It should be a little bit about money. Personal finance expert Rabina Ahmed Haq tells us what every couple should know before they shack up together. You can email us with any of your financial questions or comments. ask@moolala.ca. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
When it comes to saving for retirement, men and women are not the same. A report from TIA in the United States suggests women should be putting away almost 18% of their income to enjoy the same retirement lifestyle as men, who save only 10% of theirs. Here to tell us why that is and what can be done about it is personal finance expert Rabina Ahmed Haq. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
This is so infuriating. It's so infuriating that this difference exists. I know there are good reasons for it, but it's still infuriating.
It is. And like you said, there are good reasons as to why those differences exist. And number one is women take themselves out of full-time work for 9 years compared to men. And this is just statistically. Some women might not take themselves out of work that long. But that is the number one reason. We work less full-time years and therefore are able to save less during those working years.
One of the benefits by gender, provided you're happy with your life, is that women also live longer.
Yes. And living longer means life costs more. And yeah, it costs more the older you get when it comes to healthcare costs. I mean, you still got to live and eat and rent or pay mortgage, or, you know, even if you have a mortgage-free home, there's still some costs involved. Women live till 84. Men live till 79 in this country. And so that's 5 more years that women have to plan to be able to fund their life. And that's something that we don't often take, when I say women don't often take into consideration, that there is going to be a chunk of time, and more than likely it'll probably close to a decade, because women in heterosexual sort of typical, if you want to say, relationships tend to marry men that are a few years older. If those men then pass at that average age of 79, you live to 84, you could find yourself 7-8 years not just having to find the money to get through those years, but then also having to manage finances, which is a whole other issue, is that a lot of women have sort of let their partner take care of the finances, do the investments, pay the bills, figure out how much things cost and make things run. And so all of a sudden, after years and years and years of that not being one of their things they have to do, they have to deal with it, and it can be really overwhelming.
And it's not a surprise. It may occur as a surprise for the widow, but it's not a surprise given the statistics point to women being widows. I mean, one figure from StatsCan is, on average, they will spend 7 to 10 years in widowhood.
And that is a long period of time where you are also dealing with your health issues. So on top of maybe the fact that you are just getting older and you have different health issues, there's also things like dementia, Alzheimer's. So your capacity sometimes to take care of your finances is diminishing as well. So there's so many things to think about as a woman in her retirement, and not just, am I going to have enough money to do all the things I wished I could do when I was working, but am I going to have enough money to live?
The gender pay gap is another dynamic which we really should address, because outside of whether or not a woman took time off to be at home with family, the 9 years that you mentioned, she may well be doing a job that just simply doesn't pay as much as a male. How do you roll that into it?
Well, that is another issue, is that we are not only working less years, but when we are at work in the same job, we're making less money. So even if we, you know, we personal finance experts love to push, just save 10% of your before tax income and you're going to be fine. I mean, that only works if you are working the entire 40 years and you started saving when you're about 20, 25 years old, around that age. The older you get and the less years that you're actually working, the more you have to save. save. You have to make up for that time that you weren't working. And one of the things that you have to do is figure out a situation with your partner where your retirement income or your retirement fund is still being funded. So whether that's putting money in your RRSP or TFSA or just into a good old savings account, there is still money consistently being put into something that is going to represent money that you can use when you retire.
One of the other variables, and this one, I don't know what there is to do about it, but that's risk tolerance. So what we see empirically between the genders is that women have a lower risk tolerance, and that means on the equity portion of their portfolio, predictably lower returns over time.
Yes. So women, I mean, this is sort of being very stereotypical because I think in every relationship things are different,
yep.
But women tend to make more conservative decisions. And so what that generally means is that maybe over time they may not lose any money or any principles, but they won't actually gain much either because they're too afraid to put their money into the stock market. They're too afraid to maybe buy a piece of real estate, whereas men tend to be a little bit more risky and they're willing to go all in on something that they just heard about and maybe the payoff will be higher. And they're willing to do it at a more consistent level as well. So even if a couple of times it doesn't work out, the few times it does, it's going to pay off really well. So investment attitude, and this really comes from women by character are more sort of risk averse, more nurturing, want to make sure they're taking care of their future, but that sometimes it's to their detriment because they're not making decisions that are actually going to give them big payoffs in the end.
Let's talk solutions. I mean, there's so many variables that we've outlined there that are, it's both infuriating and almost despairing to think of how that big that challenge is. What are some solutions?
Well, one of the big solutions is you have to save more. I mean, if you're just going to deal with the reality of what we are dealing with, then you
the numbers
have to,
are the numbers the are the numbers, numbers are the numbers. Numbers.
Right. So that's number one, is that as a woman, you should be saving more. And you should be saving in your retirement before you save in your kids' RESP, before you buy something new for your home. Your retirement should be your number one priority. Because if you retire in debt or if you retire in financial distress, the people who will take care of you most likely will be your children. So you are actually doing yourself and your children a favor by making sure you save for your retirement. The other thing is to really think about how much time you want to take away when you do have children. So taking the emotional side out of it. So I'm not talking about how it feels to be home with your children and how it feels to be able to mother them for this many years. But think about your career, what it means to take 5 years away from it. Is it going to prevent you from getting that promotion? Is it prevent you from getting that salary bump? Maybe you need to still stay part-time so you're still in the loop. You're still plugged into what's happening at work. Sometimes women have this attitude that they can take themselves out of work for 5-6 years and then just hit the ground running. And that's just simply not reality.
How did you navigate that question for yourself? You've got two young kids.
Yep.
And you're, you know, here you are with a two-year-old at home. You're here with me. How do you navigate that for yourself?
So I have been freelance from before I had children, and having children sort of solidified my next 5-6 years as being a freelancer. And it has really worked well for me because I still have my eye. Well, not on the prize. That doesn't make any sense. I still have my sort of, you know, I have my ear to the ground when it comes to everything that's happening. I know what jobs are being posted. I know what work is coming up. I know who's doing what. I'm not sort of out of the loop because if you're not there, you just don't know what's going on.
Do you have license to have that conversation with other women that you know? Because I know I certainly would not have license to do that as a guy to say, consider both the financial and emotional trade-offs you're making staying at home with your kids.
So I am a big believer that unless someone asks me for advice, I don't give it. I don't give unsolicited advice to any mothers.
I should try that. Yeah. I give unsolicited advice all the time.
So if a woman asks me, what do you think I should do? So I'll give her my honest opinion. And actually, a friend did recently ask me if she should take, you know, she's got three kids. She doesn't know what she's going to do with her career. And so I gave her the advice, well, why don't you just go back part-time or fill in when the other people in your office are on leave and, you know, on vacation. She's got the kind of job where she can sort of fill in whenever need be. I go, that will keep you in the game and that will keep you your ear to the ground as to what's happening. And it will also keep you in the running for promotion or for salary bump. If you completely take yourself out of it, no matter what career you're in, whether you're in medical or technical or education, it doesn't matter. Things move on if you're not there. And it's hard sometimes to relearn things that you didn't learn because you simply weren't present.
Rubina, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Rubina Ahmed Haque is a personal finance expert. She was here to talk talk about the difference between men and women when it comes to the nest egg that they need to save. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll talk to Benjamin Felix and take him through the Moolala questionnaire. But next, we're going to take a closer look at our new online learning hub from Prosper Canada. Its CEO, Liz Mulholland, will be here. You can connect with me on Facebook at Bruce Selry Moolala or at Bruce Selry on Twitter. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Most Canadians don't feel really confident about their financial planning abilities. Sure, there's tons of information online, but it can be tough to find the resources that connect with your circumstances. Saving tips are different for people living on social assistance or dealing with a whole bunch of other circumstances in life. National charity Prosper Canada recently launched its new Learning Hub, an online platform that offers access to an array of financial empowerment resources. Joining us now is Prosper Canada CEO Liz Mulholland. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce.
Who is the hub for?
The hub is for a whole range of people. I would say first and foremost, it's for folks who are working with people with low and modest incomes to help them improve their financial health. So community organizations, maybe credit unions, but also I think policymakers, researchers, and funders can also find things. And people with low and modest incomes themselves, if they're looking for some help with financial education, we've got some great tools and resources on there.
What were the gaps that you identified? Because literally there is an infinite amount of information on financial literacy from every perspective, it seems anyway. What were the things that you felt that your target audience really needed that wasn't there?
Well, I'd say first and foremost, a lot of the financial literacy material is not designed for people with low incomes, whose financial situation looks very different, and the kind of challenges and the circumstances and the context are quite different than for people with higher incomes.
Yeah.
Also, I think we have specialized resources for Indigenous Canadians. So there weren't a lot of tailored resources for Indigenous people on there. So we have a nice money management guide with all sorts of activity sheets that folks can use that was co-developed with AFOA Canada, the Aboriginal and Financial Officers. We have tailored materials for newcomers. We have financial education materials in 10 different languages.
Wow.
So if people are working with folks in Tagalog or Spanish or Mandarin, they can find resources there that they can use in their own language.
What would be some examples of differences that someone who's, you know, middle-income Canadian, they're trying to save money by reducing their credit card debt versus someone who's literally trying to budget on, you know, two pennies that they're rubbing together? What are some of the differences that would manifest in what we try and teach people who are on a lower income?
Well, one of the key differences is one of the things we talk about with people with low incomes is asking them if they filed their taxes.
Because there are so many things that kick in if they take that step.
Exactly. So taxes for middle income people mean, oh, I'm going to owe the government some money.
Right.
And they
don't
want to.
They're going
to
grab my money.
But filing your taxes if you have a low income usually means that you're going to get quite a bit of money from the government. And if you have children, quite a lot of money. So, but there's all sorts of tax benefits there. So we really want to encourage people to tax file. And if they don't know how to do that themselves or if they're finding it hard for some reason, then really to try and call their local 211 number and see if they can get access to a community tax clinic or an agency to help.
One of the things that I think most Canadians would know is that there's cultural differences for Canadians who are relatively new to this country versus people who have been here for generations. We don't have as rich an understanding of the cultural differences between urban Canadians, descendants from Scotland, and those First Nations. What are some of the differences that would be worthy of highlighting there?
Oh, that's such an interesting question.
It is. I did an interview with someone from AFOA, and I just think it's a fascinating area. We don't appreciate the way revenue is delivered sometimes to people who are on reserve, off reserve, how taxes – like it's just a whole
I'd say there's a difference in the what financial services they have access to. So if you're living in a remote northern First Nation community, you may not have a bank or a credit union in your community, whereas if you live in downtown Ottawa, you would be able to walk three blocks and sign up for a bank account. On a cultural level, though, I think, you know, we worked with our AFOA Canada and our Indigenous partners in trying to look at this whole question of financial health and what it means from an Indigenous perspective. And really what came across was it's really all about striving to achieve the right balance between your income and your spending, your saving and your investments, and your debts and taking on debt over your life course, but in a way that doesn't just pay attention to your financial health, but is also contributing to your spiritual, your physical, your emotional health as well. So it's really a much more holistic perspective than we're used to hearing financial things talked about in non-Indigenous culture. Another key difference that came up is we think of good financial habits as being the same for everyone, but in different cultures, they place a different value on things like saving or giving, and many Indigenous cultures are gift cultures, where giving to others is a very important part of the social dynamic, and where saving might be seen as hoarding or not sharing appropriately with fellow community members or extended family members. So these are important cultural differences that really change how people think about their financial behavior. And I don't want to suggest that nobody in Indigenous communities sees the importance of saving for the retirement. They do, but the way that you talk about these things and
it's different.
Some of these things, yeah, it's different.
It's just different. We have listeners from coast to coast to coast from all different income brackets. But I would say that my hypothesis is there is very few people who understand the reality of what low-income Canadians are dealing with because so much of our discourse is around RSPs and RESPs and all these things that are available to people of privilege. What would be the one thing that you think Canadians of higher incomes should know, appreciate, and empathize about for people who are not in their circumstance?
I think one of the most important things is understanding that many of the services that we provide to low-income people around income and other supports actually, in a perverse way, stop them from building their financial health. So if you're on social assistance, there are limits on the amount of savings or assets you can have, which seem logical to a point when you, if, to the average person, but when we actually look at it, it means that somebody can't keep $500 in their bank account for emergencies, which come to all of us. You know, if you're a working person who's working but on a very low income and still receiving social assistance, and your car breaks down and you can't get to work, that means you're now fully dependent on social assistance, that you're not making that transition into full-time paid employment. So, and those savings limits really prevent people from doing the things they need to do to become more self-sufficient, assuming that they are able to work. So it means they don't have the money to pay for tuition to go back to school or take a job training course. It means they can't launch that small business that could become a bigger business that would sustain them and help employ other people. So it's really important to remove these impediments as well as providing active supports to people.
Give us the URL of the location for the Learning Hub so people who want to find out more.
Learning Hub.
And find it properly. I know. You're like, wait a second. I was supposed to memorize that. Where is it?
Learning Hub is at, not surprisingly, learninghub.prospercanada.org. Or you can just go to Prosper Canada's website at www.prospercanada.org and look in the resources section.
Right. Liz, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
And for the work that you do. Liz Mulholland, the CEO of Prosper Canada, on the organization's new Learning Hub. Stay with us. Coming up next, we'll find out what couples should know about each other's finances before they move in together. Rabina Ahmed Haq will be here. And we'll go through the Moolala questionnaire with Benjamin Felix. Let's talk book club. If you're a part of a book club, I know you probably read fiction and all sorts of deliciously page-turning fiction. How about changing it up and bringing some Moolala into your book club? You can find and order either of my two personal finance books, and the first one actually has a discussion guide for your book club to use. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Moving in with your partner is a big step emotionally, but it's also a big step financially. The financial part, though, often isn't given enough thought. Having a conversation about money before signing a lease or a mortgage is critical when a company is starting their life together. Here to tell us more is personal finance expert and founder of Always Save Money, Rabina Ahmed-Haq. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Moving in with someone means the two of you are going to start a life together, or at least you hope that you will. So a conversation about money is kind of important. Mm-hmm. What should that conversation include?
It should include everything that has to do with your finances. So your debts, how much you make, what investments you have, what obligations you have. Like maybe you've got a car payment that still, you know, is going to go on for a couple of more years. Anything that's going, because when you move in together, you're all of a sudden saying we're merging our finances. And if you're in a lot of debt and the other person's debt free, that's going to affect what they can do. Whether you can, you know, renovate the kitchen, whether you can go on that holiday, because all of a sudden your financial history affects them. So they should know what they're getting into.
What are some things you can't see until you're actually living together? Because you can talk about it all you want. I didn't know that Dennis loaded the dishwasher wrong until we moved in together. And 18 years later, he still hasn't figured it out. It makes me crazy.
Well, you usually can't tell people's spending habits. I mean, you can tell normally if they are a big spender or if they're super frugal. I think that's really easy to see. But little things like what kind of grocery store do they like to shop at? What kind of stores do they like to buy their furniture at? What do they like to do on the weekend? Sometimes that doesn't come through when you're just dating, even if you spend a lot of time together. So I know with my own relationship when we got married that, you know, even grocery shopping sometimes was a bit of a challenge because we had a different idea of where we wanted to buy our day-to-day food. And sometimes I didn't like where he wanted to go because it was more expensive than I wanted, money that I wanted to spend on lettuce or whatever it was that we were buying. And so these are things that only when you live together, it's just like even everyday habits that you're going to find out about each other. You're going to find out about everyday money habits that sometimes might surprise you and might even upset you a little bit.
There are different ways to handle the combination of finances. So some people combine everything and some people combine almost nothing. What's your wisdom on which approach is best?
So if you're moving in together, especially if you're getting married, I really do recommend that you combine your finances, especially the common expenses, completely. I mean, your mortgage payments should come out of one account that you both have access to. You should pay bills out of one account that you both have access to, and you should both be actively funding that account to whatever ability you can. I don't believe in this idea that things should be 50-50, because what if your partner makes 80% of the salary and you make 20%? So what are they doing with that other chunk of money that they don't have to
cocaine.
Put towards?
It's coke.
Yeah,
cocaine.
Probably.
Yeah.
And then what are you doing with the fact that you have to make up so much more of your a bigger portion of your salary is going towards helping the household? So the way that my husband and I do it, which is not the perfect solution, is that, I mean, I've always had that attitude, pay your bill, pay yourself, pay your bill, spend the rest. That's the I don't budget. I don't sit there and write every single thing down that I've ever bought in my entire life and try to figure out where
you and I are going to go to personal finance expert hell together. I'll see you there.
How to make it. I mean, if I feel that my spending is out of control, then I will do a spending journal for a couple of months to see where things are going awry. But when they are chugging along, I mean, you pay your bills first, you pay yourself first, you pay your bills and you spend the rest. So what I do is I put money into my RSP, I put money into my emergency fund, and then I literally just put everything else into our combined account. And we pay our mortgage out of that, we pay our bills out of that, we pay our credit card out of that. So far it's worked. But I know a lot of couples where, you know, one person has a really bad shopping habit, and so they're hiding what they're spending their money on because they don't want the other one to know what they're buying on a day-to-day basis. That's a whole different, that's a trust issue. That's not really a money issue.
How does each partner need to, especially in the early days, there may just be common law, they're just living together. How do you protect your individual assets?
How do you protect your individual assets? Well, this goes back to sort of, you know, even with women making sure that if their partner wasn't there, would they be able to still live in that house that they're living in? Would they still be able to have enough retirement money that they could still continue to have the lifestyle that they have? So insurance is a big part of that, you know, making sure that you have life insurance that if something happens to the other person. This is really talking about devastating news. But even if you split up, if you're common law, I don't remember the exact amount of time, but after a certain amount of time, it's treated as if you're married.
Yeah, married by the bank.
married by the bank, so you have to split everything. So you have to, I mean, these are the things that you have to talk about before you move in together. So don't just sort of do it because you're in love and, it, you know, you want to spend more time together and it makes more sense to just live together. I mean, you really have to see it as almost like a business deal. Like, you're moving in together, you're merging your finances, you are going to be spending, using your money to pay your expenses together. The way to protect yourself is to make sure that you're saving enough money out of your salary so that if something happens that you can still take care of yourself.
How do you account for family cultures when it comes to coupling? Because I think it's fair to say that how we were raised can really have an impact on how we manage our money in the present, either consistent with our family of origin or in rebellion against our family of origin. And that stuff can kind of be floating around in the ether and you don't see it until one person is like, organic, you can't buy organic.
Yeah. And also, your mom can't move in with us. That wasn't part of the deal, right?
Right.
So in some ways, before you move in with someone and before you get married, you should have a good idea of what their family values are. Is this the kind of family where 10, 15 years down the road, my mother-in-law is going to be moving in with me? And so have the conversation before the mother-in-law decides to move in with you. So do you plan to have your mom live with us when she gets too old to live on her own, or maybe your dad isn't here, or whatever it is? I mean, you have to have those conversations. That's the way you protect yourself, because at least you know the deal. And if you don't like the deal, then talking about it beforehand and figuring out a solution is much easier than...
What would the solution be? Like, make an enemy of your mother-in-law early so she wouldn't want to live with you? Is that what you should do?
Or you can buy a house that will suit the fact that she might live there. So it has an in-law suite or has a basement suite or has some sort of a separate area. The last thing you want to do is set yourself up in a home where you think it's just you and your kids, and then your mom-in-law is like staying in the bedroom right beside you. That might feel a little bit tight and a little bit close. But if you know from the get-go, we are going to be in a situation where one day one of our parents might live with us, you buy a house with that in mind. I say that same thing to new couples, like, just got together. Don't just buy the first thing you see. If you know in a couple of years you're going to have kids, buy a house with 3 bedrooms. Don't just buy a 1-bedroom condo, because then all of a sudden you're selling that condo, paying real estate fees, trying to get a bigger house. If you just plan a little bit, you're already in that house, and it's not like a huge jump
now,
sometimes
if you've
financially.
If you've only got a 1-bedroom condo, your mother-in-law's not going to want to move in.
Yes.
There you go. That's the amazing solution. Ravina, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Money and relationships. We could talk about that all day. Ravina Amandhak, personal finance expert and founder of Always Save Money. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. Our answerer today is Benjamin Felix. He is an associate portfolio manager with PWL Capital in Ottawa and the blogger behind Common Sense Investing. Hello there.
Hello.
How would you describe your money personality?
Analytical.
Really? And what are sorts of things that you analyze?
I analyze every financial decision, not so much that I make, I guess, but I often get questions from clients or situations from clients, and I always take an analytical approach. I guess I spend less time analyzing my own situation because I've probably already analyzed most situations that come up in my own life for somebody else.
Okay, if you had to buy a new fridge, how much time would you spend analyzing the pros and cons of a particular make and model? Do you have a Consumer Reports subscription?
No.
No, okay. So you're one step behind my brother-in-law then.
I don't know how analytical I would be with a fridge purchase. I'd probably look at online reviews. I don't know how much time I would spend comparing features.
Right. Who is your money mentor?
I might say my money mentor is Larry Swedrow, who's probably the most analytical financial writer out there at the moment.
Okay, and what have you learned from him?
That you can apply evidence from academic research to almost any financial decision, which is what I try to do.
Mm-hmm. What, now that you sound like not a lot of fun, so I'm hoping this next question will make you sound like a little bit of fun. What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures? And do not say like your own IBM Watson computer so you can analyze all sorts. It has to be like a little bit,
a really cool expense to have.
It would be.
I spend a lot on, I don't even want to tell you the, my family, I have 2 kids and a wife. We spend an embarrassing amount on food.
On food? And is this eating in or eating out?
You know what? We don't even eat out, and we still spend an embarrassing amount on food.
Do you buy organic?
We do.
Do you have an organic butcher?
We do. A farm, yeah.
I love how you can be, you sound both cool and also socially responsible. for that guilty spending pleasure. Someone who is guilty spending pleasure is like golf clubs or shoes, doesn't have that same cred. So,
right.
What was your worst financial mistake ever in your life?
Oh, in my life.
Yeah. Now, you said your wife. That could be your current wife. You could have like three wives prior. I don't know.
No. My dad always told me to marry once. So that's the plan.
Marry once. That was very smart advice from your dad. Maybe he was your money mentor.
Maybe he was. I think probably the worst, and it's not a big thing. I'm 30 years old. I haven't made that many major financial decisions. But to date, probably the worst one was purchasing a vehicle as opposed to leasing it. I've now leased a vehicle and plan to lease every vehicle going forward. Just the process of buying the vehicle and then having a used vehicle that I've got to do something with now that I need a new vehicle, it's been, suboptimal.
That is a very surprising answer, because someone who is as analytical as you are would see the financial folly of that move. It means you're always driving a car that's less than 4 years old. That is way more expensive than buying it and running it into the ground.
Yeah, but buying and running to the ground, right now I've got an old car until I get my new lease car. And it's not great. And I know that's not financially prudent, but financial decisions don't always have to optimize just for the numbers.
That is absolutely true. That's absolutely true. When do you plan to retire? I mean, you're 30, so it's going to be like 150 years from now. When do you plan to retire, and what will you do?
I sometimes think about what would I do if I won, whatever, $50 million or something like that. Believe it or not,
Oh my gosh, you're going to say I do exactly what I'm doing now. I think I just threw up in my mouth. I think I did. You do exactly what you do. Oh, God.
I'm sorry.
What is the number one lesson you want to teach your children about money?
Probably that it's important to be, one, it's important to be analytical, but it's also important to have the framework to be analytical. I think that some very smart people, like maybe a physician or an engineer, who have the framework to be analytical in general, but don't have enough basic financial knowledge to be analytical financially, can still make really bad financial decisions. So I guess that comes down to having a good foundation in personal finance concepts so that they can make good decisions.
They're going to read your blog, aren't they? You're going to make them read the blog. You want your allowance? I better see you reading Common Sense Investing. Thanks very much, Benjamin. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Bruce. This was great.
Benjamin Felix is an associate portfolio manager with PWL Capital in Ottawa and the blogger behind Common Sense Investing. That's our show for today. If you want some more Moolala, you can go on over to our website at moolala.ca. On iTunes, you can download the podcast version of the show. You can write a review. You can subscribe to the next episode. We're hanging out on the radio, but I also do a lot of TV. I'm the money columnist for Cityline, which is a national lifestyle show. You can check out those segments online at cityline.tv. Then search for me. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.